This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A big day before the U.S. Supreme Court. It takes up an issue that has been a milestone for every court for more than a half century: race and publicly supported education. For the court of Chief Justice John Roberts, court lawyers will be pleading the case for or against racial quotas, preferences, any race-based admission system in a publicly supported institution. The overarching doctrine of affirmative action will once again be on trial in the case Fisher versus the University of Texas. Here are some details of the Fisher case. UT grants admission to all Texas students in the top 10% of their class. Students who miss that cutoff are reviewed for a number of factors, including test scores, recommendation letters, and race and ethnicity. Abigail Fisher is a 22-year-old white woman from Sugarland, Texas. She missed that 10% cutoff and was not accepted to the University of Texas. She sued the school back in 2008, and the Supreme Court decided to take the case last February. We don't want to argue the details of the Fisher case this morning, but we do want to pose a larger question implicit in the arguments today before the court, a broader cultural issue suggested here by Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Listen to that. Racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today. Well, it hasn't been 25 years since that decision upheld affirmative action. That's Justice O'Connor reading her majority decision in the Grutter versus Bollinger case back in only 2003. But we pose the question today: is it time to put an end to racial preferences or affirmative action in higher education, publicly supported higher education? Paul Butler joins us to argue for affirmative action. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School and author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Hey, John, it's great to be here.
Here to argue the case against affirmative action is Richard Sander, professor at UCLA Law School and co-author of the new book, Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Richard Sander, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
We'll begin with you, Paul Butler. Let's argue for affirmative action.
Well, it's been extraordinarily successful. What it does is choose among qualified people. So if you look at a school like Georgetown, where I teach, or Harvard, where I went to law school, or the University of Texas, they get way more qualified applicants than they have spaces for. So what educational professionals do is look at factors like whether you're from a rural area, whether you play lacrosse, you know, whether you've been to Germany, and your ethnicity, your gender. What they're trying to do is to create a diverse class because that's how they know education works best. People learn better when there are all kinds of people in the classroom. And what affirmative action does is make sure that African Americans and Latinos have a seat at the table.
And the case against, Richard Sander.
Well, the big problem with racial preferences is that they're not the way that Paul is describing them. They're set aside as a predominant factor. So even in Texas or any selective institution you want to look at, there are whole ranges of academic qualifications where virtually 100% of blacks are being admitted and almost a 0% of Asians and whites. So it's not a thumb on the scale. It's a 10-pound weight. And that means that we're creating very large academic disparities between blacks and Hispanics on the one hand and whites and Asians on the other. And that poisons everything that affirmative action tries to do. It means that the students who receive those preferences tend to get bad grades. If they're in law school, they tend to have bar failure rates four times higher than those of whites. If the social interaction is affected as well, because students tend to interact, they tend to make friendships more with students who are similar to them in academic qualifications. So you find pervasive self-segregation at a lot of schools that use racial preferences. So I'm not arguing that we need to eliminate them altogether, but we do need to radically reform them and scale them down. And if the court can make them operate more the way that Paul is saying they do operate, then I don't think the dispute would exist.
Paul Butler is with us. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School, author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. You just heard from Richard Sander, a professor at UCLA Law School and co-author of the new book, Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. I want you both to address each other's arguments in just a moment, but could you comment briefly on how affirmative action is dealt with at your respective schools? Richard Sander, how is it dealt with at UCLA?
Well, UCLA is under Proposition 209, a voter initiative that was passed in 1996 that banned the use of race. And it provides a really interesting natural experiment on what happens when you get rid of racial preferences. The effects were pretty striking. At the undergraduate level, the number of blacks and Hispanics at the most elite schools, Berkeley and UCLA, went down. But those students ended up attending other UC schools. The overall graduation rate of blacks doubled over a period of about 5 years. So the number of blacks getting bachelor's degrees from the University of California has increased. It's almost doubled since the time before Prop 209. So there are institutional effects and there are system-wide effects. It's important to keep both of those in mind. Eliminating mismatch seems to strongly propel students to better outcomes.
Paul Butler, how is affirmative action dealt with at Georgetown? And respond to the Prop 2 argument that Richard Sander just posited.
Sure, John. You know, I have friends who teach with Rich at the University of California Law School, and they tell stories about teaching racial profiling, the law there, or story cases like Brown versus Board of Education, the great civil rights case that outlawed segregation in public schools, and they don't have one black student in the classroom, and only a couple of Latinos because of this anti-affirmative action law. And the quality of all of the students' education suffers. And there's a stigma against students who aren't in the classroom because what the message is that African Americans and Latinos aren't good enough to be at elite schools like UCLA or Berkeley in California. And I know Professor Sander is well-intentioned, but he's part of this sad tradition of people who say to African Americans and Latinos that we don't belong at institutions with elite whites, that our place is at lower-ranked schools. And the twist that Professor Sanders adds is to say, well, it's for your own good. But this exclusion of African-Americans and Latinos, it just feels sadly familiar.
Paul Butler, let me give you a question, and then I will pose a similar challenge to Richard Sander. If it was statistically the case, Paul Butler, that on some level it could be shown that African-Americans are on some race-based weren't as well qualified as other groups, would you concede that they should not be allowed to attend these elite schools on any level?
Of course, but qualification turns out to be a relatively easy. It's not easy to qualify to get into schools, but there are a lot of African Americans and Latinos who do qualify to get in these schools more than there are spaces for them. You know, when I listen to Professor Sanders, it almost sounded like there weren't any white students or Asian students at UC because African Americans and Latinos who get in through affirmative action are taking all the spaces. In fact, they're only a quarter of the student population. And again, it's working really well. And, you know, I'm kind of talking based on experience. I got admitted to Yale College and Harvard Law School based on diversity affirmative action programs. I graduated with honors. I've had a successful career as a lawyer and law professor. And John, my name is Legion. It includes people you may have heard of, like Barack Obama, Michelle Obama. So affirmative action has just been incredibly successful at creating a strong black professional class.
Paul Butler is a professor at Georgetown Law School. Richard Sander, a professor at UCLA Law School. Is it possible for our society to make the decision to have as a goal racial diversity, that we think that that is a valuable goal, a worthy goal, and without violating the Constitution?
It is a worthy goal. Doing it without violating the Constitution is tricky, but my co-author and I have a couple of reforms to suggest to the Supreme Court. One is that instead of abolishing racial preferences, we provide transparency. It's great that Paul and many others have had successful experiences as affirmative action recipients, but you don't hear from the people who went to law school or went to a college and failed to achieve any of their goals. Those people tend not to have seats at the table. What we need to provide is transparency so that when students are admitted to a school, they know what the prospects are at that school of students who have qualifications similar to the student who's being offered a place. If you find out that, say, at Columbia, you'll have a 40% chance of passing the bar, but if you go to a less elite school, you'll have an 80% chance of passing the bar, that's something you should be able to take into account. So transparency is a way of sort of having one's cake and eating it too. The other thing that schools need to do is that when they admit students, they need to try to make sure that they actually succeed. And if you provide transparency, then you light a fire under the school's administrators. You hold them more accountable for what they're doing. So I'm not suggesting, and I don't think the court will, eliminate racial preferences. What's needed is a reform to get rid of the worst abuses and provide more information to people in the system.
Transparency is certainly an issue before the court today in the Fisher case. We're talking with Richard Sander, professor at UCLA Law School, and Paul Butler, professor at Georgetown Law School. Before we go, both of you, comment on what you think the outcome is going to be in the Fisher case. You've suggested, Richard Sander, that the Fisher case won't eliminate racial preferences. I'll come back to you in a second. Paul Butler, what do you think is going to happen today?
Well, John, Justice Kennedy is the main man. So he said in an earlier case that he supports diversity if it's just one factor. And the way that University of Texas is doing it is exactly that way. So I'm hoping that the court isn't going to issue one of these political decisions. It kind of seems that way now because they weren't supposed to revisit this issue for 25 years. But then the composition of the court changed. It got more conservative, and now all of a sudden they're reconsidering it. So that's not a good sign. But if they follow the law and follow the precedent, they will uphold the Texas program.
Paul Butler, professor at Georgetown Law School, author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. Richard Sander, I'll give you the last word. What do you think is going to happen in the Fisher case? It sounds like you might agree with Paul Butler.
I'm close. In the 2003 opinion by Justice O'Connor that you read, O'Connor tried to lay out a series of restrictions to make affirmative action operate more narrowly. The problem is that she didn't really apply those very strictly in her opinion, and universities have taken that as a green light to use preferences that are even larger and more mechanical than those before 2003. So I think what Kennedy is likely to do is take O'Connor's principles and try to figure out ways to actually implement them so that there are tighter restrictions and we start down the path to reform.
Thanks for a great debate. Richard Sander there, professor at UCLA Law School, co-author of the new book Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Paul Butler, professor at Georgetown Law School. Is it time to end racial preference in the United States? You're debating this as well. Hey, Bruce, down in Florida, race should not be a factor in beyond the natural demographics of the various schools comprising the pool of applicants, he texts. As for jobs in the real world, the only factor should be who is best qualified. It takes courage on the hiring side, though, too. Marcy from Portland pushed back. I do not believe it should be repealed. Many people do not think affirmative action is necessary, but the majority of white Americans don't fall in the demographic that would ever encounter discrimination. And Marcia from South Carolina, she's thinking ahead.
I'm kind of puzzled as to what's going to happen later. White people are going to be the minority, and black and brown people are going to be the majority. So if they're still fighting affirmative action the way they're fighting it now, when they become the minority, what are they going to do?
Great question from Marcia down in South Carolina. She reached us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us. More from our roundtable of Lake County voters in Ohio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.